everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is episode 629, Marvel Monday. And Manny and I are going to be talking about a few of the books that came out on Wednesday, December 5th. And then we'll also continue our look at the Charles Soule run of Daredevil with issue number 12. So quite a few good Marvel books came out last week. Manny, what do you have up first?
I'm going to start off with Winter Soldier number one. That was written by Kyle Higgins and with artwork by Rod Reese. And this is pretty much picking up after Bucky Barnes has been pardoned by the government for his involvement with in taking down Hydra, fighting Hydra. And so now what he's doing is he is helping people get out of, sticky situations. For example, the issue kicks off with him in Chicago. It actually doesn't start with him. It starts with the police officer named Arthur Hayes, who apparently is in on a heist with other officers where they're going to come into a bus that they're scheduled to partake in, and they're going to take half the weapons and half whatever's there before the actual raid, and then they're going to sell them or do whatever it is they do with them. And by the looks of it, this cop Arthur Hayes has been kind of he's stuck. He doesn't want to do this, but they have leverage on him, and he has no choice but to go along with it. Going into his apartment, the Winter Soldier is waiting there for him. Finding out that what the Winter Soldier does is you can contact him, and he goes case by case, and if you qualify for his services, he'll actually come in, get you out of your situation, and give you a new identity, a new job, and get you out of that sticky situation that you're in. But obviously things are not that easy as for whatever reason, the other officers came back and they ended up having to fight their way out of his apartment. He's based now out of Shelbyville, Indiana, where, he meets up with Tony, who's fixing his arm, and then they start talking a little bit more about what he's doing and some of the things that we talked about. And then what's really interesting is a little bit later, he meets up in Wisconsin with another one of his, clients, you can call it, who is not adjusting very well to his new environment. He misses his friends. He misses his family, specifically his girlfriend. He doesn't like his job. He says he's not gelling well with the people. And it's interesting just because, you think about the fact that he's putting these people in very safe areas, but maybe not thinking too much about the psychological damage that it would do to them to just kind of rip them apart. But in his defense, he's also saying that, hey, you were probably going to die. You were going to do some really bad things if I didn't get you out of there. You were the one who called me. And that's something that these people have to deal with too. There's a new character that's introduced at the end. Don't really want to spoil it. I'll be honest, there's nothing necessarily special about this book that I found it to be super compelling. Being that it's a Kyle Higgins book, I kind of expected a little bit more, and it's okay.
Nothing. Yeah, kind of a group. No, go ahead.
Yeah, fine. How's it?
I kind of agree with you. Maybe Kyle's a victim of his own success because most of his stuff just grabs you right from the beginning. I thought there was value to it because I thought it was interesting. Brubaker, when he brought back Bucky and the Winter Soldier story arc, he kind of did some examination of him, as far as how he feels about being turned against Steve Rogers and his, friends and having lost decades of his life. But ever since then, it hasn't really been touched or explored. So it's been enough years, I think, have gone by since Bucky came back that it's worth asking the question and kind of exploring it, you know, from a different writer's perspective. And I know Kyle's a huge fan of Winter Soldier and, you know, he's a big fan of Ed Brubaker, you know, as a creator as well. So I expected a lot. I think the jury's still out. I think there's worth here, but I'm not sure yet where this is going to go. But I think the art, I think Rod Reese does a great job. I love his style of art. It suits the kind of book that Kyle, the kind of stories that Kyle wants to tell. And what I love about this is, especially going from the previous Winter Soldier book, the one that, I think it was Ailish Kot that did it, that was like, it was in other dimensions and it was like super weird and out there. Like, man, I love having this more grounded story. He's almost like the A-team, you know, you have a problem and no one else can help. And if you can find him, you know, as opposed to him fighting alongside Thor and doing all kinds of crazy cosmic stuff, you know, this is a more personal kind of a, you know, a smaller story, a street level story almost. So, I think it suits what the things that Kyle wants to explore, kind of the more interpersonal relationships. So I thought it was good, not great. But I, you know, the jury's still out. It's only issue one. So we'll see where it goes from here. What do you think of the art?
The art was good. There was nothing, but like I said, it was an okay book. I wasn't blown away by anything. If anything, I did like, you know, the Winter Soldier is a type of character who can drive this story, this kind of story, where it's really grounded, which is good in its own way. But the artwork, it was all right. Not my favorite, but it wasn't bad either. I do kind of like some of the flashback scenes where it's a little bit more, the pencil lines are a bit more defined. And it's just you can tell that they're memories, and it's not part of what's actually going on. That was okay, and so I mean nothing major. The only one I didn't like was near the only page I didn't like near the end was where there's a fight scene happening, and then some of the pages just go to pretty much black and white except for the blood. I hadn't seen anything like that throughout the rest of the book, so it felt kind of out of place. There's just so many variations of colors in throughout the book. It did throw me off a little bit.
Yeah, that's kind of what Rob. I mean, he started off as a colorist, so plays around with color a lot. So
yeah,
I tend to like his artwork. You know, they did Cowl together, which is, you know, of an era, Cold War type era, which kind of suits Bucky. And yeah, I am very intrigued by that last page and that new character that gets introduced. That seems like the most intriguing twist in the book. I mean, it definitely has me, you know, wanting to come back for issue two. So
I thought it kind
of, you what?
No, I was saying I found that introduction kind of bland. Also, I was expecting a little bit more. I was like, all right.
It just seems so crazy and out there. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah,
so, that's yeah, I definitely want to learn more about.
Not in a good way per se, but
all right, fair enough. All right. Well, first book I'm going to talk about is The Best Defense: The Immortal Hulk, number one. So just to give some background, Marvel's bringing back the original Defenders. So that's the Hulk, Silver Surfer, Namor, and Doctor Strange, which I thought was a really weird combination of characters to make up a super team. And also interesting that the Hulk was a founding member of the original Avengers and a founding member of Defenders. So, you know, he's the only one that kind of crossed over and was Iron Man, Giant Man, Wasp, and Hulk, and Thor. Those are the five original. And then Captain America came in with issue four. So anyway, it's kind of interesting. And in order to kind of reintroduce how these original four Defenders come back together, Marvel's releasing some one-shots. Immortal Hulk, the Best Defense number one, Namor, the Best Defense number one, and then next week, or this week as you're hearing this, Doctor Strange, the Best Defense number one, Silver Surfer, the Best Defense number one, and supposedly you can read those in any order, and then they're going to come out with Defenders, the Best Defense number one as this new Defender series, and I think, I'm not 100%, but I think it's being written by Al Ewing, but I'm not, don't hold me to that, I'm not 100%. So anyway, I read the two Best Defense issues that came out on the 5th, the Immortal Hulk, and also the Namor one. So in the Immortal Hulk one, Banner, and again, this is very much in keeping with what's going on in Immortal Hulk. And in fact, it's pretty much, well, it's written by Al Ewing. The creative team is not exactly the same. We have Simone DeMayo on art and Donna Sanchez Almara doing the colors. So it's not exactly clear where it fits in to Immortal Hulk. I mean, clearly it's in that same vein. It's definitely horror. The Hulk is, you know, the same as far as personality. The relationship with Banner is the same. And, you know, we'll be talking about Immortal Hulk number 10 here in a minute that also came out this week. But, so he's somewhere in New Mexico, which is where Hulk is right now in his regular title as well. So I'm assuming it takes place kind of after the current story arc, but he's walking around. He says he has a hunch. He feels drawn to something, and Banner's talking about how hunches aren't really his thing. Gut feelings aren't really his thing. That's the other guy that follows that stuff. You know, he's the scientific guy. He's the logical guy, but he feels drawn to this place, this barn in New Mexico. And what he finds there is a skeleton, and it turns out it's the skeleton of Doctor Strange. And he notices that the Eye of Agamotto is missing. And so he's trying to figure out, okay, what happened? Because it's making him angry. As much as he had disagreements with Steve, as he referred to him as, he considered Doctor Strange a friend. And even more so than Banner feeling that way, the Hulk feels that way to the extreme. So he heads for the nearest town, and when he gets there, it's eerily empty. And he does notice somebody peeking through a window. And as he heads toward the door, knocking on the door, kind of forcing his way in, gets a gun in the face. And then we get an interlude. And there's this blue-skinned alien with four arms that is working in some kind of laboratory with these, like, test tube-looking things. And all of a sudden, out of the shadows, someone says, boo, someone like covered in a sheet, like straight out of, I cut two eye holes in my mom's bed sheet to go to trick or treating as a ghost kind of thing. And he stabs us. He says, boo. And he stabs this alien and he laughs, hee, hee, hee. And he walks away and it says interlude complete. So it's just completely out of left field. Like no idea, no context and no idea what's going on. Meanwhile, back in the small town of New Mexico, Banner gets in a fight with this guy who's in the house. He just wants him to leave. And Banner just wants to know where everybody is. And this guy's, I mean, they just have a knockdown drag out. I don't really understand it. We're not giving the context of why is this guy fighting so hard to not answer Banner's questions. Banner is definitely the worst for wear after this fight, but he does manage to get some information, and that's head to the local watering hole, head to the local bar. When he gets there, he finds this vagrant, and the vagrant has the Eye of Agamotto. So he tells his story. There's also, I should say, some police officers in the bar that all look like they're kind of frozen in place. They're not able to move. And the vagrant is using the power of the Eye of Agamotto as well as he can. You know, he's not a trained magic user. But he tells Banner that, yeah, he came into the town. He was looking just for something to eat. The police officers roughed him up and dispatched him outside of the city limits. He came across the barn. Dr. Strange is already dead. He felt the amulet call to him. He picked it up, and he claims to have looked at himself and seen the truth, because that's kind of what the eye does. It shows people what's what's real, what's at the core of them. And he's used its power to kind of take revenge on this town. So Banner's like, okay, I understand you wanted revenge. You had it. Now give me that, because it's my friend and he wouldn't like the way you're using this tool. And he's like, but your friend isn't here. So fair warning, don't make me use the eye on you. And Banner's like, well, why not? Let's try it. And the guy's like, what? And he's like, come on, it's magic, right? Let's see, bring out my hidden truth. Go ahead. And the guy's, he's really thrown off by this. Like, why would anybody want to have it used on them? Banner has seen what it's done to the whole town. So he gets in a little bit of a scuffle with the old guy. And the old guy orders the cops to protect him. And there's a little bit of a fight. Eventually, Banner gets his eye, his hands on the eye and turns it on himself. And what does he turn into? Of course, but the Hulk. And normally, the Hulk doesn't, in these days, doesn't come out during the daytime, only at night. But he's able to, unleash his alternate ego of the Hulk, and basically tells the guy, all right, get out of here before I use it on you and show you what you don't want to see about yourself. And the first clue we get that something's happened to Doctor Strange, obviously we know something's happened, but the first clue we get about who killed him is when the Hulk says, I know who killed you, Steven. You did. And as he looks, we see this really like older looking version of Doctor Strange, like obviously like a spirit, an astral form. He's got a long beard. He's got like a bandana tied over one eye. He's sitting in a lotus position, floating in the air. And he responds to the Hulk by saying, well, Hulk, thereby hangs a tale. So Doctor Strange dead with an astral form that looks ancient, much older than he normally looks. The Hulk out in daytime and in possession of the Eye of Agamotto. What happens to the town? It'll probably won't even be addressed in the rest of the story, is my guess. And that strange interlude, which I imagine is going to be the threat that brings the four together. So it was okay. It certainly felt in keeping and tone and mood with the regular Immortal Hulk series. So I appreciated that. There's not enough there in terms of clues to what the regular Defenders title is going to be about yet to say whether or not I'm interested in checking out the Defenders rather. So, we'll have to wait and see. And I will talk about the Namor issue next, which also doesn't really offer many clues, but I'll let you go ahead and cover your second book next, Manny.
Okay, well, let's keep talking about the Hulk. Second book is Immortal Hulk number 10, written by same author as your title, Al Ewing, with pencils by Joe Bennett. And then it's inked by Rui Jose, Lebeau Underwood, Rafael Fonteris, and then Paul Mounts on colors. So, this has by far been one of Marvel's best books currently. And I mean, the action just does not let up. The issue 9, the Hulk was going toe to toe with the Absorbing Man. And it just seemed like he for once maybe was going to be a little bit outmatched just because of the fact that he can take his energy. As we can see in the beginning of issue and also we left off with Creel left kind of cut in half. And so now the fight continues, and Jesus Christ, that is just gory and brutal, and they're just going back and forth. And it's like the Hulk says, for a while, it's stalemate because they're just swapping energy back and forth. But I mean, what he does to this creature's spine was just nuts. I mean, he beats him to the point where, I mean, it's like he has guts hanging out. He has his skull and spine looking out. I mean, just super gory, super super intense. And at the same time, you have Alpha Flight, who have changed their name, I think, to Gamma Flight. Trying to find the Hulk, and at the same time, you have the people in charge of Creel trying to take hold of the situation. But at this point, they're in New Mexico. They're right where the original Gamma bomb went off, and in the issue, we find out why. It's because there's so much energy left in the earth from that blast that the Absorbing Man should be able, he's going to be able to get it out. So Ewing's continuing to tell one hell of a story. And then with Joe Bennett's art, there has not been, I feel, a weak point so far. I mean, just some of the facial reactions of the Hulk to certain things as he's fighting, when he's talking to some of the people on the Gamma team. I mean, just done so well. And then the details on all the gore, although very a little gut wrenching, it's still really, really good. I'm not sure what more else I can say about this issue other than go ahead and pick it up. I'm going to tell you, it was a little bit uncomfortable for me to see kind of that, withered down Hulk with the skin hanging and then the thin body and like the weird neck. And I mean, just so good. Really, really good. And just not to spoil what's going to happen, but the last panel with the Hulk, his facial expression tells you what the hell they've got themselves into, and I love it. It's another really great issue, and probably my favorite book from Marvel right now.
Yeah, you know, I agree. This book's been out already, so, you know, we wouldn't be hugely spoiling, but sometimes there are things that happen in the issues that, you know, it hasn't even been out a week yet, so we don't want to give away everything. But yeah, I agree with you. This is somewhat of an uncomfortable book, and I have to say that I think it's the best book Marvel's putting out right now as well, and that's coming from a guy who's a huge fan of the Hulk, but not really the style of the Hulk. Although it's never been done, Hulk's never been as close to being a horror book as it is in this. You know, even in the early days when it was Man or Monster and it was Stanley and Jack Kirby, he was a little more of like a Frankenstein monster kind of, but it wasn't to this level of horror. You know, this is more sophisticated. And what's great about this is, and you know, I talked to Al Ewing about this when I was at New York Comic Con, it's how much he's going back and mining from the original run, from those first six issues, and you know, then you know, the subsequent issues when it was in Tales of Suspense, I think, with Doctor Strange. But I mean, even in this issue, you know, Hulk is back at the place, his birthplace, where he became the Hulk, and that figures into the story prominently with the entity that we still haven't, you know, had identified for us and what it's after, and it leads into, you know, more kind of things that with that cliffhanger ending. So it's definitely a horror book, which is not my favorite kind of Hulk story. It's not where I would prefer to see him. So that just goes to show you just how exceptional that this story is and this title is that Al Ewing and Joe Bennett and the rest of them are crafting, because even though it's not my favorite kind of Hulk stories, I'm still saying this is the best book Marvel's putting out. It's just unique and different and fresh, and yeah, it's really, really good. And we're not the only ones that think so. I mean, that Little Hulk is I mean, I couldn't tell you the last time, if ever, that I remember seeing the Hulk title as like the top 10 in like the top 10 selling books of a week. This is a top 10 book. And I'm not talking like top 10 Marvel book. I'm saying across all comics, it's in the top 10 every week. Every week it hits fans. So, all right, let me go on to my next title. It's The Best Defense, Namor Number 1 from writer Chip Zdarsky. Art is by Carlos Magno. Color art by Ian Herring. And letters are by Travis Lanham. And much like the Immortal Hulk, this is a one-shot that stands on its own, and I have no context. I couldn't even tell you where Namor showed up last in a Marvel title. I have no idea. But the book starts out with him debating with his advisors. I use the air quotes on that, his council. And they've counseled him to stop the madness. His plan is crazy. And he kind of listens to him and then basically tells him, all right, now you can all shut the hell up because I'm the king and I'm going to do what I want. And apparently what he wants is to go to Vodan and ask the Vodani to rejoin Atlantis. Apparently the Vodani are Atlanteans that at some point in the long past split. Some say they were driven out of Atlantis for some reason. And they've gone and established a kingdom elsewhere. So he has a little trouble, Namor, getting there. It's a perilous journey. And at one point, it's so far under the water that the jellyfish, the phosphorescent jellyfish that he has kind of leading the way so he can see, like, is crushed to death by the pressure. And then Namor has some flashbacks to World War II and being on land and just needing water. And he kind of blacks out. And when he comes to, he apparently has made it to where he needs to go. But right before he gets there, there is another one of those interludes where we see the guy in the bedsheet apparently attacking and killing other aliens. And he doesn't say anything. He just laughs and then stabs the alien and kind of runs away with purple blood on his knife. So, again, no context. So we get back to the story of Namor. Namor, it's a week later. He's been traveling in these foreign waters, and he keeps getting attacked by different monsters, he calls them. It just looks like giant sea creatures, basically. So he's fighting like a giant lobster, giant crab, and such. And as he's wondering if he's losing his mind, the waters are so unfamiliar. How is it even possible? It's like a dream or a nightmare. He's attacked. Apparently, he's finally come across some Vodani, and he thinks he's going to be able to defeat them. He's yelling at them in typical Namor speak. Fools! Namor comes in peace, but if pushed, I will gladly finish with Violet. And then he gets attacked from behind. Blacks out once again. When he comes to, he finds out that the girl that attacked him from behind is the princess of Vodan. And he explains to them who he is. You know, I'm King Namor. I've come to you unarmed. You strike me from behind. And the king shows up and he says, do I hear you correctly? This vagabond whom we collected off the seafloor is a king. And he explains, I'm Namor, king of Atlantis. And he says, I'm Oaken, king of the Vodan, the only acknowledged king in these waters. And Namor says, I'm here to invite you back to your rightful home. And Oaken is like, man, the arrogance of, like, what makes you think that we've just been sitting out here waiting for Atlantis to call us back home? You're a fool. And Namor is trying to convince him, saying that there's some kind of impending doom coming from the surface. And, you know, he wants to protect all of Atlantis and all of the races and creatures that live under the sea. And they need to work together. You know, Namor says, I'm half human. I know of the surface world. You know, I'm not just talking out of my butt. The time of reckoning is upon us. You know, we all need allies. We all need to secure the world and make it safe for water breathers. And King Oaken says, well, it takes a bold man to just stroll into here, into a kingdom of people that you rejected to form an alliance against the enemies. You know, and the sarcasm is clear. And Namor's just, he's trying to persuade him, doing his best at diplomacy, which obviously is not Namor's strong suit. And the king eventually says, well, you know what? I will give you a chance. There is a monster that patrols the kind of the outskirts of our colonies. It's called the Skurlak. And if you can defeat it, then perhaps I will return the favor and we can think about joining forces. And so he goes out there with the princess, all along protesting, saying, you know, the king gave me this, you know, this task. I don't know why you're coming to help. And, you know, she's like, I want to protect my kingdom. And, you know, I don't really agree with my father. I'm curious about the surface world. And I think perhaps you're right. We should, you know, we should team up. We should perhaps work together to make sure that the surface world doesn't harm the water breathers. So eventually, only by working together, do Namor and Katawh, I think her name is Katawh, they're able to defeat the giant sea squid creature. And the king has been there with some of his soldiers all along watching. And Namor's worried that he's not going to uphold his argument because Namor was supposed to slay the beast himself without the help of Katawh. And the king actually never had any intention of helping Namor or joining at all. He says, no, I'm not going to help you. And Namor says, you must have air bubbles within my ears, for I swear I just heard you renege on a deal with a fellow king. And he says, no, I reneged on a deal with an Atlantean. We're never going to fight side by side with you. I didn't come here to watch you slay a beast. I came here to watch the beast kill you. And if the beast didn't, then we would. And so they attack Namor. He dispatches King Oaken's soldiers pretty easily. But then when he goes to fight the king, it's a pretty even match. And eventually what Namor does is take him up out of the water, because obviously Namor can breathe out of the water, but the king can't. But what he discovers as soon as he leaves the water, he has traveled a lot further than he thought, and it's not really clear how this is possible. But when they leave the waters of Vodan, they're in outer space. So Namor can't breathe there either. He lasts a lot longer than King Oaken does, but then he's just kind of floating there in space. Katawh is above the water. You know, she's surfaced, and she's looking up at the two of them. And Namor eventually loses consciousness. And he's kind of floating there. And then all of a sudden in the background, we see a silver surfboard zigzag its way. And Namor regains consciousness, but he's shimmering and shiny, like he has the skin of the Silver Surfer. And it says to be continued. So I'm assuming the surfer saved him and somehow sent the board to maybe give Namor a little bit of power cosmic to allow him to survive in outer space. Don't know. I guess we'll find out either in the Silver Surfer one shot that's coming up, or maybe in the Defenders, the Best Defense title. So there was a lot more to this story than there was to the Immortal Hulk story. So I liked it for that. Just the fact that it was, you know, more like a meatier narrative. There was more to it. And also, I'm not generally a fan of Chip Zdarsky. But a lot of the stuff I've read from him has been more of his humor stuff. Like, I tried to read Howard the Duck, and oh my God, was that awful. One of the worst comics I've ever read. It was so horrible. And so I've kind of stayed away from his work. And I know he's done some Spider-Man work, and I know he's the writer on the upcoming relaunch of Daredevil. And I was pretty disappointed to hear that, because I've been loving Charles Soule's take on the character, and I wanted it to continue. So I'm trying not to be biased, and I will pick up Zdarsky's first couple issues of Daredevil and see if it's any good. This gives me hope that maybe Zdarsky does more than just write like comics he thinks are funny that aren't really funny at all. Yeah, it was an enjoyable issue. You know, I'm going to read the other two Defender one shots and probably give the book a try. Didn't overwhelm me. but it was better than the Immortal Hulk issue. So, and the art was really solid. I'm not familiar with that, that artist at all. But it's got, he had pretty good line work. I thought the line work was really solid, and the color work, I mean, Ian Herring, I know his work and he's always solid, but yeah, Carlos Magno. Yeah. Never heard of him before, but really detailed backgrounds, especially in the Atlantean scenes, good storytelling. So he might be one to watch. He may, we may be hearing more from him. Wouldn't surprise me, because it's really good work, especially from somebody that I hadn't heard of before. All right, what do you have up next, Manny?
The next book I have is Killmonger number one, written by one of my favorite writers, Brian Edward Hill, with artwork by one of my favorite artists, Juan Ferreira. This usually is not the typical book that I have on my radar, because I feel a lot of times that titles like these, titles like Shuri, which ended up also being a really good book, et cetera, are kind of just almost like made just to make a quick buck just based off of the popularity of their characters. So I wasn't necessarily going to pick this up, but then I found out the creative team, and I had no choice but to pick it up, because in my mind, Brian Edward Hill was not just going to do a cookie cutter story for five issues about what Killmonger was up to in between his banishment from Wakanda with his dad, and also his return to Wakanda when he fought for the throne, and then eventually, obviously, we know he died. There's no spoiler here, because this is very well known. He had been dead before in comics, and then he was dead in the movies, and now he's been brought back to life. I was not let down, because Brian Hill really is going to take these five issues and really allow us to get to know the character. So the reason why they're banished is because Ulysses Klaue forced his father, Njobu, to help them attack Wakanda, and of course that didn't work out. Now, years later, he's an MIT graduate, and I mean, he can pretty much get any job he wants. Anything he can do, anything he wants, as his counselor is telling him, and he said no. The reason why he says no is that he's just been, he's just about to graduate. So in his mind, he's just about to gain his freedom again, only to become, enslaved by a corporation that wants his services. So he is just looking for his own path. But his path is revenge against Klaue for his role in his current predicament. But what we see in the character is that he is the Killmonger that he is a very, very unpolished version of the Eric Killmonger we see in Black Panther, because he has that rage, he has that anger, and he has that I'm the biggest man in the room feel to him, but he doesn't necessarily know how to use it. He's not refined enough to do it well. So in a sense, he's really clumsy. And this is all evident because he does find Klaue, but unfortunately, the transaction that Klaue is making is for the Kingpin. And due to this, the Kingpin always backs up his employers. He has extra men on an extra team that has been actually watching Killmonger the entire time. And this man is his codename is King. He has a couple of people working with him with their codenames Knight and Rook, obviously from a chess piece. But it's funny how King just kind of really, really nonchalantly treats him like he's seen him before, like he knows what kind of guy he is. So he actually, instead of killing him on the spot, brings him over to the Kingpin and presents him to him, which is pretty cool if you add that little twist into it. But when he's asked to dispose of him, King actually lets him go, which ends up being an entire ruse just to see what he's up to, because King sends in another one of his lackeys to try and take him out because he didn't heed the warning of leaving the city. And I mean, in a rage, in the type of fight that you would expect Killmonger to be in, he actually, the way he kills him is super, super brutal. In fighting, they break a window to the outside, and there's like shattered glass just pointing down on the upper portion of the window. And he takes the guy, puts him in the window, and just slams it shut on his head. Just brutal. But as he does that, you just see the rage on his face. I mean, just insane amount of anger in the character, only to have Rook standing right behind him, and it was all a test for him. He wanted to see if he was a better man, and he talks about how he's stupid for the way he's going about things, and how they can help each other out. He can help him with a couple of jobs, and eventually by signing with Kingpin and doing work for him, he can get him to Claw, who now has gone into hiding because of his failed attempt at his life. Even it being a good idea, he's still super stubborn, and it takes King to reveal that he has a couple of powers of his own that kind of changed his mind a little bit. And so that's where it leaves off with that. And we'll see where it goes from there. He does end up accepting, and it's like it's really, really interesting, because at one point he also talks about he's looking out into the ocean. He's to a place that his ancestors called Dishala, which is a place where the wrong dead wait for justice in the world of the living. But he says that he looks out to it, but he has to imagine it because he currently does not have the faith of his father. And in his own imagination, if it's his imagination, it's super interesting, because he tells himself, "Down your war, return home." So it makes it really, really complex, because he's trying really hard to get vengeance on this on Claw, but at the same time, there's a part of him that all he really wants to do is he just wants to go home. He wants to be part of the society that has ousted him. Even in the earlier parts of the book, he sleeps with his counselor, but then he actually belittles her as somebody that is not even to his level because of his Wakandan heritage. So, I mean, part of all of this, part of his anger, part of his rage is the fact that he can't go home, that he can't be the person that he was born to be because of who he blames as Claw, because of what he did with his father, and now he plans on revenge. But Brian Ruho talks about this a little bit, talking about that anger is the primal scream for fear. So he's using a lot of this anger, a lot of his emotions, to mask the fact that he's scared that he's never going to be able to make it back to his homeland. And then you can kind of take the same information that you got out of here and kind of put it towards what you've seen already in the film, and see exactly why he's so passionate about his homeworld, why he's so passionate about the fact that he's been out in this world while so many different atrocities has happened. Meanwhile, Wakanda has stayed put, stayed quiet, stayed out of it. and it's part of his anger. I'm just trying to understand why, and trying to get back to what he believes is his primal, his right. I mean, just probably the exactly what I had expected from a book written by Hill. Not as much depth as I had expected from a book that's only going to be 5 issues, and that's really like connecting the dots from a gap in the film. And then if that weren't good enough, I mean, the Fairy Rare art is fantastic. Great facial expressions throughout the book. I mean, just different looks in Killmonger as he's going through his journey. I mean, just different faces of anger, different expressions, just beautiful, clean pages that change the tone of the color depending on the setting. I just overall, I think this is a fantastic book, and I'm so glad that I didn't miss out on it.
Yeah, I was like, Brian Edward Hill is writing a Killmonger book. Yeah, I'm probably gonna have to check that out. His work's pretty good. I know nothing about Killmonger. I haven't read any Black Panther. Haven't seen the movie. And obviously I know just in general, you know, the story just from being a comic fan for so long, but I don't really have much interest in those characters. Just never, whatever, you know? So I was like, I'm probably gonna have to check it out. Then I heard Juan Ferrer was doing the art, and then I'm like, all right, well, I'm definitely gonna read the series and we'll see, you know, like, I don't know how much I'll get out of it because again, I'm not bringing any context into it. Man, it was so good. It was so good. Like the Juan Ferrer art, like I'm a huge fan of Juan ever since his work on Green Arrow. Used to talk to him on Twitter all the time. Had never met him until this last October at New York Comic Con, which was amazing. And he showed me some of the pages from Killmonger. Just a super nice guy. Really, really talented. And his this is recognizable as his art, but it definitely has a different tone and feel than his Green Arrow work. Like there's a page of kind of flashback where Killmonger's thinking about some of the things that he went through when he was growing up in Wakanda. Whenever it's a flashback, that looks more like what Juan's art looked like in Green Arrow. And it's a little more watercolor. It's not quite as defined. The lines aren't as solid. The rest of the book, it's a more solid feeling art than his work in Green Arrow. And his work in Green Arrow was phenomenal. But this kind of more grounded, gritty, street level art that he's doing to tell the story of, you know, this kind of a grounded, visceral character, it is amazing. This is like the best art I've ever seen Juan do, without question. I mean, it is just stunningly good. From, like Manny said, the facial expressions, the storytelling, the emotion. I mean, it is like, I really think with the kind of high profile of Black Panther, this book's probably going to get a lot of attention, being that it ties in with Black Panther. And all of a sudden, Juan Ferreira, like, this book's going to make him a superstar. It's just based on the quality of it. It is just stunningly good. As far as the story itself, I mean, it's Brian Edward Hill, and he's exploring things that are personal to him, you know? And it's not only, I think Killmonger not only has like anger and fear about not being able to return to his homeland, but I think he has a lot of anger and fear. He's scared of who he is, and he's angry that he's not good enough. That's why he got ostracized in the first place. And that's there's a lot of that there under the surface. Like he's worried that he's not good enough. It's why I think that scene where he sleeps with his college guidance counselor and then, you know, makes the remark as he's leaving. It's like, yeah, you feel she's beneath you and yet you still wanted to, you know, quote unquote, conquer her. And now you feel, you know, you feel bad. It's all about like acceptance. You know, like, let me get this white woman to, you know, want to sleep with me. You know, so there's a level there of some, like, he's torturing himself. There's like self-confidence issues, and it goes really, really deep. And again, it's no surprise, as Manny said, with the skill of a writer like Brian Edward Hill, that the story operates on so many different levels. So definitely recommend picking it up. I mean, if you're a fan of the movie, then 100% go and pick it up. Because the thing is, you know how the story ends, right? I mean, we all know, as Manny said, that Killmonger is going to die. But it's one of those, you know, the classic cliche, it's not the destination, it's the journey that matters. So yeah, stunningly good book. I mean, that artwork is just next level by Juan, man. It is just so good. Without question, the best art I've ever seen. Anyway. All right, on to my last book that I'm going to talk about. It's Marvel Knights, 20th Anniversary, number 3. Story by Kenny Howard and Donny Cates. The script is by Kenny Howard. Art by Damian Cosiero? C-O-U-C-E-I-R-O. I probably butchered that. Apologies. Color work by Matt Miller. Letters by Corey Petit. And so this is interesting. All the Marvel Knights books have been co-written by Donny Cates. So I think basically what's happened is Donny, along with these other writers, probably got in a workshop the overall story. And then they're all taking turns on scripting different issues. And for those that don't know what's going on, haven't been following along. So it seems like an alternate universe, alternate reality here for Marvel. I don't know how much it ties into the main books. But basically what's happened is we're kind of back in that Marvel Knights world. So Daredevil, Elektra, Punisher, Hulk, imagine we'll see Moon Knight at some point, Black Panther. And what's happened is Dr. Doom, along with a couple of other baddies, have tasked the Kingpin to like oversee this world, at least New York anyway. But the other thing they've done is they've created some kind of machine that erased everybody's memory. So you have all these heroes living like alternate lives. Like Frank Castle's a New York police officer and he has a girlfriend who's an EMT. Matt Murdock's just a blind lawyer. Elektra teaches martial arts. She has her own like martial arts studio. And so there are no heroes. There's no heroes, and the villains can just do whatever they want because the heroes don't know that they're heroes. So apparently the Hulk still knows, and what the Hulk has been doing is at night he's been writing notes to Bruce Banner, giving him this information, and then Banner went and sought out Frank Castle, and when he starts telling Castle, some of the memories start coming back, so he gets Castle on his side, which is kind of what the story is in this issue 3. It's kind of a flashback of events that happened before the first two issues of what Banner and Castle go through, and how Banner kind of convinces Frank Castle that, yeah, they've all had their memories erased. And then once he gets Punisher on his side, then they go after Daredevil, they go after Elektra. And at the end of this issue, we see them all basically agree to work together because they all sense that, this isn't really the world. The world's really not the way it's supposed to be. And are they ready to start like fighting back and finding out what's going on? Well, Castle says, well, we're not done yet. There's one more. And Elektra says, so who is it? And Banner says, and you turn the page and we get a full page splash of Black Panther. So I guess they're going after T'Challa next. Banner even holds out the note that has T'Challa written in. And it's funny, they were thinking all along that these notes were written by some children. These children are leaving me notes at night, but it's because it's the Hulk. So the handwriting's really bad. But anyway, Banner holds out the note and he says, does anyone know how to pronounce this correctly? So it's been an interesting story. I wasn't reading much Marvel at the time that Marvel Knights came out. But I feel like this does honor the legacy and the feel and the tone that Quesada and Palmiotti brought to that line. And it's an interesting story. The art here is okay, not great. We do get to see Tony Stark. We get to see Thor. And I imagine it's pretty fun for these writers to kind of give different takes and different like personalities almost to these heroes. Like Stark's actually in jail for insider trading. He says he's framed. He's still a jerk. And Castle goes to try to recruit him. Stark basically has the prison guards attack him. And when he goes back to Banner, Banner says, so it was a bust. And Castle says, if there's a world where that punk isn't in jail, I don't want to know about it. So it's things like that have to be a lot of fun for the writers to just give a different take on these heroes that they, you know, normally you're really restricted and you have to, you know, stay in character and you can't say certain things, but this is, you know, being that it's an alternate reality, they kind of, you know, the shackles are off and they can have a bit more freedom to tell the story. So, I can't remember right now how many issues. I think that maybe it's a 6-issue mini. So we're probably about halfway. So it may be that, you know, issue 4, they go and recruit, T'Challa and then find out, in issue 4, kind of who the bad guys are, and then have, or issue 5 rather, and then have issue 6 to kind of finish off the final battle, the climax, whatever, and then have a little time for cleanup. So yeah, Castle definitely is at the center of this particular issue. I feel like Daredevil was more the focus on issue 1 and 2, but I think Castle's a good, he's a good, like, point of view character for us, because he's more than anybody, he really is living such a different life, right? I mean, the guy was a killer and a vigilante as his, you know, normal day job in the Marvel Universe, and here he is going the complete other way, you know, taking a vow to serve and protect as a New York police officer. So again, it makes for a good juxtaposition, and I've been enjoying the story quite a bit. Again, I wish the art was a little better. It's serviceable. It's not great. It's another one of those examples where I'm like, man, this is a pretty important series, right? It's the 20th anniversary of Marvel Knights. That's what this series is all about. You think they would put like a really solid artist on it instead of, it hasn't even been the same artist, because I think it's been coming out weekly or bi-weekly. So, you know, but get a couple of really good artists that have similar style and have them trade off issues. But and that doesn't seem to be the way that Marvel likes to do things these days. So anyway, it's definitely worth reading despite the inconsistent art. It's been pretty solid. So all right, now on to the last book I'm going to talk about. We have been covering the Charles Soule Daredevil run that has recently concluded. And I think we're up to issue 12 to talk about in this particular issue. And we saw at the end of issue 11, it ended with Daredevil discovering the villain, the new villain that Charles Soule has introduced to the title, the one that's been behind the recent death. We saw him paint a mural out of blood, 113 different victims' blood. Victims haven't been found. And then in issue 11, we saw that this villain had killed a bunch of the Inhumans and then posed them as doing very human things. So Inhumans being human, so to speak. And that was his supposed work of art. So Dark Art Part 3, written by Charles Soule, art by Ron Garney, colors by Matt Miller, and letters by Clayton Cowles. And it starts off right where issue 11 left off, on top of that rooftop with Muse. We learned that that's the villain's name, and all he wants to know is, did Daredevil like the art? And, you know, he's like, I'm an artist. That's what everybody wants to know. You know, did you like it? You know, do you like my work? Tell me, do you like my work? And Daredevil's response is, you mean the people you murdered? And Muse's response is, well, is it murder if you give people what they want? Like, if the people want to die and you murder them, isn't that giving them a gift? And Daredevil throws his billy club at Muse as an answer, and Muse's response is, so you didn't like it. But Muse grabs the billy club right out of the air and snaps it in half, and Daredevil's like, uh-oh, not good. Then Muse pulls out a grenade, pulls the pin, Daredevil beats a hasty retreat, but what he realizes as he takes cover is it's just a lot of light and sound. It's just a flashbang. It wasn't really a grenade at all. It was just another performance. So Daredevil heads back to the crime scene, and once he gets there, he realizes that the new Atalan security team is there analyzing all the victims, discovering who they were, And I'm pretty sure that this is the first appearance of your favorite Inhuman and mine, Frank McGee, head of New Adelante Security, got called in. Any crimes to do with Inhumans are the jurisdiction of the New Adelante Security Force. It supersedes any kind of jurisdiction for any human law enforcement, NYPD, FBI, any of that. So Matt Murdock gets to meet him. They chat. Murdock says, "Matt, you don't really sound like an Inhuman." So Frank McGee gives him the lowdown. "Yeah, I used to be a cop, NYPD for 26 years, and, you know, carriage and miss road crew, and I had to leave. The higher-ups got nervous that I had powers." And he shows off his powers, you know, how he could take a picture of a crime scene with his eyes and then analyze it, zoom in, zoom out, better than any crime scene photo. And so Matt says, "Well, you know, I'm working with Daredevil on this. I'd really appreciate if you guys could share what you find." And he said, "Yeah, you know what? If it were up to me, maybe. The problem, though, it's not up to me." So he has to ask Medusa. So Daredevil goes to New Adelan and asks Medusa, and she doesn't even consider it. It's just a straight no. He doesn't even get to finish his basically asking. She holds up her hand. "Nope. Sorry, you wasted your time." And he's like, "You didn't even let me explain, and you know why I'm here, and you tell me no. People's lives are at stake." And Karnak says, "Yes, yours. You heard the queen. Nothing for you here. Time to go." So Daredevil's not about to leave. He says, "No, I'm not leaving until I at least get to make my formal request." So he ends up getting into a fight with Karnak, and Karnak actually underestimates Daredevil, because we know Karnak, his superpower is to kind of sense the weakness in things. So it's not too long into the battle before he realizes that Daredevil's blind. And once he realizes that, I mean, not only is he an Inhuman and have superpowers, but he's also a monk, right? So he immediately goes silent, holds his breath, stills his heart, but he doesn't know about Daredevil's radar sense. So even though he's not making any sound, Daredevil is able to see him coming and basically gives him a pretty good kick to the chest and knocks him out. Daredevil makes his formal request. Medusa still says, "You know what? I understand, Daredevil. I do understand how vital it is to find this killer and quickly, and yet I must refuse you." So Daredevil leaves, only because he's persuaded by Frank McGee, who says, "Easy there. Let's walk. You know, it's time for you to go." And what ends up happening is Frank McGee agrees to somehow get any information he finds to Murdock, who can then pass it on to Daredevil. Because the whole reason Medusa is refusing is because of everything that's happened at this time in the Marvel Universe with the Inhumans. You know, the Terrigen Mist got released. There's all these new Inhumans. Their numbers have increased, you know, 10 times what they were previously. And not everybody believes that Medusa is worthy to rule and can protect them. So anytime any Inhuman is killed or hurt, Medusa has to be, she's got to be the one that protects them. So in her eyes, she's got to be the one that catches this killer to prove that she can protect her people. If somebody else catches them, she thinks it's going to look bad on her. And Frank McGee is like, "You know, this is my city. You know, I'm on your side. You know, as much as I want to do my job for New Adelan, this freak's killed Inhumans, and I just want it wrapped up as, you know, as quickly as possible." So, you know, once a New York City cop, always a New York City cop, right? So he just wants the sicko caught, to put it in his words. He doesn't care who gets him. So Daredevil ends up getting what he wants anyway. But as he's standing there about to leave, after having this conversation with Frank McGee, his phone rings and it's Blindspot calling, and Daredevil's like, "Blindspot, what is it?" He says, "Daredevil, after Murdock and I were done in the Bronx, I went back to his office. I was in the courtroom helping," and Daredevil's like, "Why are you whispering?" "Because he's here." Muse is in the middle of the courtroom. We see he's already killed a couple of deputies. He's got the judge with a knife to his throat, and we get the to be continued. So definitely a fast-paced issue. really fun issue. And the highlight was seeing Frank McGee for the first time. He's just as cool and kind of badass as he was in the Return or the Hunt for Wolverine miniseries that we read. So, this last issue, when Daredevil had said to Blindspot, "Hey, these are Inhumans, so we're going to have to call the Inhuman Security Force and find out who's in charge of that. And they'll probably be the ones that are going to come in and take charge of the investigation." Like, as soon as I heard that, I was like, "Oh yeah, Frank McGee, that's who it's going to be." And sure enough. And so, right from the start, Charles Soule gives him such a distinct voice. I'm still saying, man, I want my Charles Soule, Frank McGee miniseries or ongoing series. I would read the crap out of that. He's just such a great, no-nonsense, interesting and fun character. As far as that artwork goes, I mean, it's the regular art team, Ron Garney, Matt Miller, you know, I've said it 100 times when covering this book. It's street level, it's gritty, it's visceral. The fight scenes have a lot of fluidity to them. I love the way that Garney depicts Daredevil when he's using things like radar sense and, you know, other powers like that. He has a new take on it that I think is done really well. And Matt Miller from the color work, Matt Miller, I've seen him color so many traditional books, and this is so not. It's such a limited palette that really makes the book look kind of stark and more street level and more gritty. And it perfectly suits the tone that I think Charles Soule is going for. So we're going to keep covering the Charles Soule run. We have about another 35, 40 issues to go when all is said and done, because I think his run was about 50 issues. So I think it's all good, and it's all worth covering and talking about. And it's really fun to go back and revisit these early issues that I pretty much have forgotten at this point. It's been so long since I've read them, and so many books have come out. I've read so many books in between. So, really great job by the entire creative team. And, you know, I heard some people criticize the Charles Soule run. They think that it maybe moves a little slow, or they, you know, for whatever reason, they just don't particularly like it. And that's fine. Not everybody's going to like every title that comes out. But I think, especially now that Charles's run is finished, now is a good time to like go back and read it and trade, because I think ultimately, if you read it in big chunks, you know, if the pacing was an issue for you, you don't have to worry about that. Like, throw that out the window, right? Because you can, at this point, you could buy trades of his entire run and read them all in one sitting if you think that the pacing is that slow and then you get all the story at once. So I don't feel that it is slow. I wouldn't mind having more story in each particular issue, but that, I don't think that has to do with the pacing that Charles is giving the story. It has more to do with the fact that comics are only 20 pages now. So I think if you take this artwork and the stories that they're telling and you try to cram more into each issue, you're going to need more panels with smaller art. And then I feel the art and the style that Ron Garney's using is going to lose some of the impact. This kind of art needs space to breathe, and it's so integral to the story and the tone that I think you have to do it this way. So anyway, that's my two cents. So anything else you want to add about any of the books we talked about tonight, Manny?
No, not necessarily. No.
All right. Good enough. Well, we want to thank everybody for joining us as always. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.